Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Okay, as you all know, if you listen regularly, which I know you do because you're smart, well-informed, and good-looking people, I love books. I love them a little too much, although there are certainly worse vices to have. I like to promote authors as much as possible on this show, partly because, in our age of tablets and smartphones and now AI, reading, certainly deep or even sustained reading, is becoming a lost art, and physical books are diminishing in importance. When I come across a book that I think is especially valuable, intellectually and maybe even aesthetically speaking, especially one that can serve as a centerpiece of education and enlightenment for the whole family, I like to get the author on to talk about it. For example, recently I had, on two separate episodes, the authors of a glorious two-volume work called The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. Those books are essential histories and reference books, particularly for Christian conservatives who are tired, as I am, of woke secular influences, as well as the books being gorgeous works of art in themselves. Today, I have the author of a very different kind of work, but it's also a big, beautifully done, and very valuable book for the whole family. It's one you are most definitely going to want to have, especially in light of the fact that this year is the 250th anniversary of our great nation. I have the book myself, and trust me when I say it's something your home needs. I'm going to talk with the author about why that is. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale College. He's the author of a couple of previous illustrated works, including Mr. Meehan's Mildly Amusing Mythical Mammals, a best-selling illustrated book of poetry for children, and now a brand new work called The American Book of Fables, which I have in my possession, in my hand, literally as we speak. And I have a lot to ask him about that. Matthew Meehan, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Thanks for your time. This book, The American Book of Fables, is just astonishing. But before I get to it, let me ask you, you write for both scholarly and popular audiences, but writing children's literature seems like a very important focus for you. What draws you to that?
A number of things make me want to communicate in that milieu for, you know, the younger reader, but also just for the whole family. I think common sense is something that is very important and has to be sort of shaped. And so if you write for sort of popular, polemical outlets, and if you write for scholarly, that's for scholars and for people who like polemics and politics. But if you want to actually have the whole country share your sentiments and write opinions, you have to do something a little more popular than popular writing.
That is a good point. May I ask how many kids you have and how old they are?
I have a whole passel of children, 8 children. yeah, that's right. It's not a race, but I keep winning. I have two college students and all the way down to a 5-year-old. So I have 5 boys and 3 girls.
Awesome. I have 5 myself, but I feel, as a Catholic, I feel kind of like a slacker. And compared to you, I have some catching up to do, although at my age, I think I'd better just call it a day.
That's right.
What do they think about your work?
They love it. They like me to read it aloud. They like to go run off and get lost in it themselves. When I'm writing it, they often have things to say. I've benefited from their criticisms. They're my alpha testers of the product. Huh. So they're big fans, and I'm always very grateful when they start to talk about the books or even start drawing and coloring and telling their own stories. One of my sons with this project has started to write his own fables, which are pretty funny. So,
oh, that's awesome. Well, let me ask you about Mr. Meehan's Mildly Amusing Mythical Mammals. Poetry is very undervalued and neglected in our time, maybe in all times, but I think especially our time. as a homeschooler, even I tried or tend to neglect it, and I should know better. Why is poetry so important to children's intellectual and moral and even imaginative development?
It's a very powerful and potent and compact way to teach and impress beauty upon the imagination and the heart. And it's also one of the most sort of powerful rhetorical trainers. That is to say, a small poem of, you know, 14 lines can communicate so much truth. And in a democratic republic where you actually need to get good at communicating while not bloviating for hours on end, poetry is actually a really powerful way to train the heart and the mind to speak powerfully and beautifully, but in a compact way.
Well said. Okay, let me ask you about the American Book of Fables now, which is just out. This thing is epic. It's beautifully illustrated and well organized, which I'll ask you or talk to you about in a moment. Not the kind of book you sit down and read straight through from cover to cover. It's something you browse through or dive into at random, or maybe more systematically by region or whatever. Tell us about how and why American geography is so key to this book.
I wanted to blend the principles of the country with the people, the places, and in a certain sense, the providential glory of this beautiful land. Because I think that we sometimes, like equality, rule of law, natural rights, freedom of speech, these principles are like eggs, but they're very fragile. And if they don't rest in a certain kind of nest of gratitude, thanksgiving, and just wonder and admiration for this wonderful country we've been given, I think they tend to fall from the tree and crack on the sidewalk. So I didn't want to do another one of those kind of the Declaration of Independence and here's the principles of liberty, because I actually think that we've hit that hammer, or we've hit that nail with the hammer enough times. We needed something a little more artful, and the turn of the screw was something more beautiful, was keen to me. And I also think, you know, in an era of sort of irreligion, an era of acidic criticism where everybody's sits as judge over everyone else as if they were some sort of god in their own right above all other mortal men, a certain amount of piety and gratitude towards God, nature and nature's God, which are featured in the Declaration of Independence, that seemed to me to be really appropriate to help people fall in love with America again.
Exactly right. How did you go about researching those different regions represented in the book?
I traveled. Actually, I won an NEH grant and an innovation prize. And basically, I brought my illustrator with me on some of the trips for some of the real climax chapters at Yellowstone and Glacier National Park. But I also went to Sequoia National, Yosemite, the Redwood Forest of Northern California, Monterey Bay, Biscayne National Park, Everglades, the Florida Keys, the Shenandoah, the Great Lakes.
Wow.
I went all over the place. And talked and got the local park rangers to help me. I studied local history. I bought the local books of folklore. And so every part of the country, you get to actually learn about the land, the ecology, the wildlife, the local history of settlement there. And you know, if you're really going to love the country, you can't just sort of love a few very sort of stark points. And you need to actually sort of, it has to become a homey love where you know a little something about the Everglades and you know a little something about Zion National Park and you know a little something about the Redwoods and which tree is tallest and you know, what kind of animals live on the tree. And so a lot of the fables and stories and nursery rhymes actually weave in history, ecology, and folklore.
Excellent point. You mentioned your illustrator. Let me ask you about that, because the publisher didn't just send your book off to some illustrator and say, you know, draw some pictures for it. You two actually work together. You work with your illustrator regularly, and the illustrations in this book add so much and give it such an extra layer of character. How do you work with your illustrator, John Folley? It's Folley, right?
Yes, John Folley.
How did you work with him, and how does his work help shape the book?
So John and I are actually old friends. We used to teach together at a prep school here in D.C. Before he went off to become a master painter under Paul Ingbritson. He's a realist impressionist trained in the Boston School through the École des Beaux-Arts. he can trace his master apprentice line all the way back to Raphael's workshop in Florence. So he's very excellent illustrator. And the two of us spend a ton of time basically creating these Google Doc files that explain what each illustration means, its symbolism, what visual quotes from the tradition of painting and artistry, what little Easter eggs. Like, for instance, we have a beautiful oil painting, and he painted 13 3-foot by 5-foot oils and then dozens of beautiful watercolors and hundreds of pen and ink. So it's a very well illustrated and gorgeous book, as you said. Yes. But for the main big 2-page splash oil painting for the Great Plains, which is the section on the right, you know, the right to liberty in the Declaration, the Great Plains, you know, cowboys, buffalo roam, sort of liberty. How do you understand liberty in the American context? The painting is of a buffalo and different creatures and a prairie schooner wagon. And there's a forest, a prairie fire in the background. It's part of a story that comes up. But in the back is actually Purple Mountain's Majesty. And it's actually the Pikes Peak where Purple Mountain Majesty, where America the Beautiful's lyric about Purple Mountain's Majesties was written. And it's also a visual quote of a famous Remington painting as well. So we try to weave in all of these various sort of symbols and ideas and also folklore and art from the country's history into all the illustrations, which gives it this feeling of vitality and depth that is hard to come by. I can't imagine handing my work over to be illustrated by some random person without being in deep right. communication. And we spent years practicing. We used to do political cartoons just so we could practice. We did it for a year before we did our first book, just to practice being able to put my ideas into his pen. And it turns out it's not as easy as it seems to really have a unified vision between illustrator and author. And we consider it like a kind of triumph of our friendship, because it takes patience.
Yes, I bet. Well, there's just a wealth here. I mean, in addition to the awesome illustrations, there's this wealth of poetry and fables and witty and wise quotes. And it's for all ages, too, I should emphasize. I homeschool, and this book just seems tailor-made for that, for family read-alouds. And I guess that was your intent, wasn't it, to create a book that would be a focus for the whole family?
Yes, I wanted something that a child could grow up with over time, but I also wanted something that the entire family could engage at almost simultaneously. So you can read nursery rhymes for littles, and then you can flip and read aloud to them some of the fables. And then, you know, they can wander off if you continue to read some of the bigger things, the letters from the founders. But there's also stories with this one character, Hugh Manatee, that travels around the lower 48. And those can be read to children. In fact, they love these stories, but they're in the big section because they're complicated. But I encourage parents to use their judgment about which stories to read aloud to their kids. But I wanted it to have an upper story. And there's serious political, philosophical, civic, and moral work being done in the bigs section and in the middles too. So I'm a political philosopher. I'm a professor of government. I'm an educator. I've been doing curricular design for 25 years nationwide. And I do leadership education. So there's a lot I'm up to in this book that's not just a nice little story with a single moral.
I can vouch for that. And why did you feel compelled to give classic fables an American spin in the first place? How did that idea even come about?
I realized that part of what the fable tradition is looking at animal types as... So let me back up. People don't know this, but it was considered a statesmanly thing to do. A serious person would keep some animals because it would help them study their own natural and animal appetites. So literally, like if you train a dog, you learn something about your own appetites, right? And if you train two dogs, you realize, there's two different kinds of appetites and the same species, but this one's not like that one. And so it teaches you how to deal with other people. It makes you a little more prudent about the passions that have to be managed in your workplace and in your family. And that was normal. In fact, there was actually a zoo above Independence Hall while they were working on the Constitution, Peel's zoo. And they were stuffed animals, not live, but they were designed to teach you about the animals of our country. But it turns out the animals in our country present new and interesting, useful moral types. The busy beaver, sort of the technological passion and techno joy, which is America is very innovative, but has to deal with that passion in a prudent and sensible way. And so I actually have a beaver that's part of the story named Nikola. After Nikola Tesla, they meet him in Southern Colorado where he was doing his experiments. So, but you wind up, there's lots of work to be done to help shape the moral imagination. And I realized America's never had a great fabulist account. We've never had it. We have the lion and the tiger, but we've never had the grizzly and the buffalo and the beaver and the bald eagle. And there's lots of wonderful work that I got to do.
Beginning of the book, you have three short quotes from John Adams, George Washington, and the Book of Matthew about the necessity of being guided by wit and wisdom and discernment. How can fables and poetry and other forms of children's literature help foster those qualities in a child's character?
Well, just fiction in general versus a moral treatise or a lecture, right? It puts things in action. And so there's tragedy and comedy, which means the reader's forced to sort of judge characters, good and bad. And there's a lot of gray characters, right? Someone who has a mixture of good and bad behavior. And that alone is a kind of training in one's good mother wit, as Chaucer put it, to sort of, you can tell a hawk from a handsaw, to quote Shakespeare. And that's really important for self-government. In fact, it's so important that there's actually an image of wit on the pediment of sculpted into the Capitol building on the House side, the east pediment of the House of Representatives in the U.S. Capitol. Hmm. It's that important. So, and Ben Franklin wrote about wit and wisdom all the time. And fables in particular are very, very useful for this because there is a simple moral, but oftentimes in the fable genre, a simple moral doesn't quite cover what you just read. And so you're kind of on the back foot going, well, I agree that that is a moral I could take from this story, but it seems like there's something else going on in this fable. And it sort of forces you to really sort of, you know, be more cognizant of the fact that appearances can be deceiving. Not everything is as straightforward as you would like. And that's exactly the kind of wit you need to be a self-governing people who doesn't get taken advantage of and get their liberties taken out from under them.
You spoke a moment ago about the moral imagination of children. I think in the age of AI and tablets and screens, I think some people would say, why bother? Why is having a moral imagination important anyway? You've got all these technological capabilities that can imagine for you. What is so important about having a moral imagination?
A colleague of mine likes this phrase. If you wanted a healthy body, you would not send a robot to lift weights at the gym for you, would you? Right. The analogy is, I think, very apt that when you make decisions, Seneca, a favorite of the founding fathers, Seneca, the Roman philosopher and playwright and fabulist, said that when you make a prudent decision, you're using ingredients from your pantry of imagination and memory. And it really depends on what is there for you to make that prudent decision. And if you just rely on the bots, you're relying on an inhuman thing that really has not appraised what is beautiful and what is best and what is good and what might be fitting and proper. They can't do prudence for you. And prudent decisions, beautiful deeds, require a beautiful imagination, a pantry so that you can cook a beautiful dish. And if you have bad ingredients in your memory, you will make bad decisions. And that's, I think, just you can't run from that.
That is very well said. And as I mentioned before, there's plenty for grown-ups here. There are letters and journal entries from the founding fathers, excerpts from Cicero and other classical authors, a lot of great reading for adults. I've sat down with the book and just gone through it myself, even without the kids. What is it that you hope to impart to your adult readers?
The same that I want for the children, in that I want to help build up their wit and wisdom. I want to give them a richer and more informed account of patriotism and what the American character and the American sort of way of life demands of us. But also, you know, that sounds too harsh. I just want to accustom them to the wonderful souls of the American settlement and founding, so that they feel more kindred and unified, and they love them more. I try to show a number of beautiful People like Jim Cook is featured twice in the book. He's a cowboy, but he was also a guide for the Union Army during the Sioux Wars. He was a hunting guide for British lords who would come to Yosemite to hunt elk and grizzly. And he has incredible stories that just wed you to the land and make you love the country more. But at the end of the day, for the adult reader or for the deep reader, even in the middle grades, I try to actually basically give an account of what human nature is, and thus, how do you actually protect our natural rights and liberties? Well, because if you don't have a good view of human nature, you're going to err in what you think you ought to do to protect it.
Well, this book happily coincides with the 250th birthday of our independence, and you weave excerpts from the Declaration of Independence throughout the book. From your personal perspective, are you seeing something among your students and maybe even your children and their friends of a patriotic revival among young people?
I think so. I think the classical education and liberal arts movement, school choice, homeschooling, pre and post COVID, I think the cat's out of the bag. The prairie fire has been lit, and I don't think even a Stalinist pogrom could drive it out of the American ethos now. And I think that's an incredibly hopeful thing to recall and remember. I'm very pleased to see that this kind of study of the ancients and study of one's ancestors and all that is the sort of grammatical study, all that has been said that is good and beautiful from the past is causing a revival of patriotism, piety, and I think religion amongst those who are exposed to it. And more Americans are being exposed to it. So yeah, I think this book is a kind of heirloom celebratory sort of pillar of this project, but it's much wider than my book alone.
Yeah, this book is a great place to start, though, that's for sure. I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but I wanted to mention something at the end of the book. You actually have an activity or a set of activities for kids. You've hidden some treasures that you want them to identify. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, all three of my books have seek and finds. I mean, maybe I'm just a sort of jumpy ADHD person, but after you read a book, you kind of want to just flip around in it again. And so I create these sort of treasure hunts where they have to find, like, how many American flags can you find, right?
Yeah.
I've hidden in the thing. Or can you find a creature from my previous book hidden in one of the pictures? But there's also lots of things that you can learn. There's easy finds, not so easy finds. You know, can you find an elephant? Well, what's an elephant doing in an American fable book? Well, it turns out there is one hidden on a shelf. Can you find a pair of earmuffs, right? Can you find five white pelicans? There's all these different species, like an alligator gar is hidden in the water in one painting. So we do this kind of thing just to kind of show and begin to introduce the reader to the depth of care that every illustration and frankly, the sad part is I don't do a seek and find of literary material because that's too tendentious and annoying, but it's a kind of image of how careful and how deep each of the texts and the illustrations are.
Yes, well, I can confirm that that's sort of a project, that seek and find, that's something that would completely animate my kids. So I think that's a great addition to the book. Do you have any favorite selections yourself in the book?
I do. I mean, for me, at the very quiet heart of the book is a kind of argument for how America should see itself as a republic. And I take that to be the central core in a certain sense of the book. And so I have a favorite fable that takes place at the Grand Canyon. And it's pretty long, so I won't read it, but it's basically in the very middle of the book. And it's about a rose bush and a carpenter, a rancher who basically makes a lattice work for the rose bush. And the rose bush is beautiful, but it's languishing. And then he eventually assembles this beautiful lattice work, and then it grows much more powerfully, much more, it flourishes much more beautifully and fragrantly. As this couple watches the sunset on the Grand Canyon and he speaks to the flowers and they say, see, we told you it wasn't in our nature to grow so high. And he says, well, Maybe it was in your nature to grow so high with the help of a carpenter. And that carpenter is obviously a double pun on both, you know, a moral and religious people, i.e. Christ the carpenter, right? That you need grace to thrive. But it's not simply that. It's also an image of the carpenters that built this country, the framers of the Constitution and the drafters of the Declaration and the people who made this republic and set up all of our laws as a kind of latticework for the people. And I think that's a very traditional image of the republic, of res publica, that there's a natural thing, the people, and then they can either be in a framework that is less natural or more natural. And the more natural your frame, and I think America has one of the most natural frames, or cooperative with nature, then you have flourishing. You have, and that's part of why this country is so great, is it was set up to really let us flourish. And that's kind of a favorite for the adults, and it's quiet and it's a pleasant little tale about the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Grand Canyon, and a famous old rosebush, the largest and oldest rosebush in America, that is growing in Arizona.
This book is just out, and I know you're still kind of deeply immersed in it and in the promotion of it, but do you have something else in mind, something else in the works?
So I have three projects. We'll see, depending on work and publisher demands, that are forthcoming. For children, the next thing, it depends on which one publishers think is best, but I've got two more books. One, I don't want to say much about it yet, but it's a particular character that's a story that I've been telling my kids for years. And it teaches about the management of anger and wrath, which I think is a real thing we're going to have to deal with more and more, because right now we're, as you know, left versus right. We're in a very contentious age, which means we're going to have to figure out how to manage that passion very carefully, lest we lose the republic. And then I'm working on a book about a kind of response to Machiavelli's Prince, about how to be not a prince, a number one. That's what prince means. It's literally a number one. But a secundus, how do you be a number two? And I think it's actually, there's a number of things that can be learned that that Machiavelli passes over rather unwisely. And forgive me for sounding haughty, but I can make a few corrections to a very serious mind. That's all right. So those are two. And then third, I'm working long term on a very big book, on an academic book on Cicero's On Duties, which I've been teaching for 20 years and have a lot to say and need to say it soon.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I can speak just for myself when I say that I am desperately in need of your book on anger. So please hurry with that one.
Me too.
Yeah. Professor Meehan, how can people best keep up with what you are writing and thinking? I mean, are you much of a social media guy?
I actually, I have a fairly active Twitter account. As I say, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll think less of me, but more often. So you can go there. It's MTMEHAN. So Matthew Tracy Meehan, MTMEHAN. And that's the same at Instagram, although Instagram's only really active when I'm launching a book like now, but that'd be fun. But my Twitter account is, I usually put what I write out there, my popular stuff, some of my scholarly stuff. And I'm a little bit of a commentator, but that's where I would suggest people go. And then dc.hillsdale.edu is, a lot of my, that's my home base, the Hillsdale and DC campus, where I help run the grad school that we founded about 8 years ago.
Good to know. Yes. And obviously people can seek out your books as well. Listeners, I strongly urge you to get the American Book of Fables. It is a unique and invaluable addition to a family library. It's the kind of thing you'll want to hand down to the next generation or purchase for your kids. It would make a great gift for friends, families. Matthew Meehan, thanks for joining us at The Right Take. I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you, Mark.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.